8, after which the remainder of the book is devoted to explaining in more detail what Daniel saw in both of these great chapters. Now, I assume that most of us are quite familiar with the prophecies, so we'll pass over the prophetic part of Daniel 7 fairly quickly. First of all, in chapter 7, verse 1, we have the timing of the giving of the vision. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sun of the matter. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. Now this dream was given to Daniel in the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. And I'd imagine that Daniel had been by this time about 67 years in Babylon. Let's just take a look at the time sequence in this respect to get our perspective straight and clear. Apparently the vision of Daniel chapter 2 was given quite early in the period when Daniel was there in the kingdom of Babylon. Certainly about 3 years went by, during which time he was in the University of Babylon, and sometime shortly after that, the vision of Daniel 2 was given to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Belshazzar had only 3 years of reign, because in the third year of King Belshazzar, we have 1, 2, 3, Babylon was destroyed. And Babylon was destroyed at the end of a period of 70 years after Daniel had been taken into captivity. So, if the 67 years after Daniel was taken into captivity, possibly it was quite accurately a period of 67 years. So Daniel was a long time in Babylon before he did get a revelation from God of this nature. I know in my own mind I've had the tendency to think that Daniel's whole life is filled up with wonderful visions. They came one after the other. But when you think in terms of about 67 years going by and Daniel being probably about 80 to 90 years of age, then he didn't have visions throughout the length and breadth of his life. Well, that's a good question. If it was when the kingdom fell, of course it was more than 67 years. But I'm not quite sure about that point. Actually, I did assume that the first attack made by Nebuchadnezzar upon Jerusalem was, I know that's when Daniel was taken away captive. Well, think about that and do some more research and then see what we come up with on that point. In any case, if that was so, of course, then Daniel was more than 70 years of age, because he spent some time about, as we saw the other day, about how long was it in Babylon before Zedekiah fell? 23, yes, right, because the last king of Israel was 11 years on the throne, and the one before him was 3 months, and the one before that was again 11 years, and about the third year of that king, Daniel was taken prisoner, which made something like 19 or 20 years after Daniel's captivity. The fall of Jerusalem marked the beginning of, possibly the beginning of the 70 years. At the moment, of course, my main point is to show that the incidents of revelations from God to Daniel were not frequent in a very, very long lifetime. And he was at least, as we said, about 70 or 80 years of age before the first of those revelations came to him. And that revelation is recorded here in the 7th chapter of Daniel. Now in this dream, Daniel saw these four great beasts. Those four, the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs of the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, it devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now we'll just lay out a kind of a diagram this evening to illustrate the successive rise of these great beasts and then determine what each of them symbolized in the revelation given to the prophet back there at that point of time. This line represents, of course, the passing of time. And the first thing that Daniel saw was a great lion with wings, followed by a bear, which rose up on one side first. Then came a leopard, which had four heads and four wings. And after this came this great and dreadful dragon, with 10 tremendous horns. And as we shall see, there was a little horn which was this, which came up after them in turn. We'll now read the next verse, which says in verse 8, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots, and behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And there we find that 3 of these horns are plucked up to make way for the little horn, 3, we're putting in the words 4, and then we come to the little horn, which had a mouth speaking great things against the Most High. Let's pass on a little further to verse 9. The next great event after the rise of this little horn power is a judgment scene. I beheld till the thrones were cast down. Now you may notice in the margin of your Bible it says the word placed. Some Bibles it says set up. And we get the idea from the English translation that we had before us, the King James Version, that here was the overturning of world empires and kingdoms and thrones and so forth. But the actual fact is that the picture given here is the preparation of a judgment room. Now back in those days, the court of an emperor or king was usually a large circular area with a marble floor. And before the judges came in, servants would go around and they would throw down these huge cushions about 3 or 4 feet across and maybe a couple of feet deep. And then the officials would come and they'd sit on these cushions cross-legged around the room. And that's the kind of picture we have in this particular verse. We tend to be misled by the word cast down. The marginal reading says placed, and that is the more correct rendering. Although once you understand the imagery being portrayed, there's no real problem. So the thrones were cast down or placed or set up, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. So the very next event portrayed in this prophecy is the judgment scene, and this takes place in the presence of the King of Kings, that is, of God the Father. Moving on now to the next several verses, which complete the vision itself. Verse 11, I beheld then, because of the voice of the great word which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beast, they had the dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. So the end of the story, as it is back in Daniel chapter 2, was the setting up of the kingdom of Jesus Christ, which of course is an eternal kingdom. And that of course is the end of the prophetic outline. Now when this was shown to Daniel, he was very, very distressed by what he saw, as verse 15 points out. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. Now why was Daniel so distressed by what he saw? Didn't this vision bring to him a picture of the ultimate glory of the victory to be gained by the Church of God right down at the end of time? Shouldn't Daniel therefore have been rejoicing that that would be so? And yet we find that he was grieved or filled with sorrow by the picture which was portrayed before his mind. There was a very good reason for Daniel's sorrow. Let's turn now for a moment to Hebrews the 4th chapter, and we'll give some consideration to God's purpose for ancient Israel. Last year, of course, we spent quite some time in the study of Hebrews, the 3rd and 4th chapters. So this is now familiar ground to us in this audience. Now, in the first verse of this chapter, Paul is talking in terms of God's people entering into God's rest and warned the folk of his time of the great danger of their coming short of God's plan and purpose in their lives. Verse 1, let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. And then the following verses talk about the presence of God's power in the world, it having been there since the creation of this world at the very, very beginning, and reminds them of various folk who failed to go in because the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. So we come on down to verse 6 where it says, seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Who were they to whom this verse was first preached? Well, Paul doesn't say, particularly in this chapter, excepting he does go back as far as Joshua, as we shall read in just a moment. Now, it's very obvious that God did not plan that the church would have to wait through 6,000 years from the creation or from the fall of man down to the end of time for his children to enter into their eternal rest. Now, of course, while we're upon this earth at the present time, we are to experience rest from day to day. But what is the ultimate rest that God plans for his people? Heaven or eternal life? And God planned long, long ago that should have been the blessing which would have come home to God's people. And so Paul says in verse 6, I read a moment ago, seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Again, he limiteth a certain day, that is of course a day of opportunity, saying in David, today after so long a time, as it is said, today if you'll hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Verse 8, for if Joshua, and again read the margin rather than the actual text which says Jesus, if Joshua had given them rest, then would he not afterwards have spoken of another day? Now if we draw another diagram here, which has no relation to the one above us, which fills the entire board of course, we'll go back now and look at the history of the Church of God prior to the Babylonian captivity. In other words, if we consider the end of this diagram up here to be the beginning of the other one, with the lion, the bear, leopard and so forth along the line, we'll now come back to a point of time referred to by Paul as David's day. Now, here we find the great King David, and David's day, God provided the opportunity for Israel to enter into rest, and he called that after so long a time. Not a short time, but after a very long period of time, in David's day, another day of opportunity was given them to enter into rest. And only in David's day, because back in Joshua's day there had been a failure on the part of God's folk to enter into rest. Now we've seen why, haven't we, in our studies last year, the Israelites failed again and again to enter into what God purposed for them. They failed to escape from the sin and suffering and imprisonments and captivities which this world brought upon them. Now why was that? Because they followed the Babylonian principle of man being the problem solver and the plan maker. And while man occupied that position, of course, the work of God could not possibly be finished. And as we saw in our studies of the historical part of the book of Daniel, during the reign of the Babylonian period, when Daniel was in the court of the Babylonian king, He lived under conditions that were as unfavorable as they possibly could have been for the Church of God, when the disadvantages were all on his side so far as material things are concerned, and all on Babylon's side so far as money and numbers and those kind of things were. And yet Daniel demonstrated the mighty power that is available to just one person, or just four people as the case may be, and proved that Babylon could not overcome the Church of God when that church was utterly and completely true to God. We saw that as we went through those first chapters. Now naturally, of course, Daniel, knowing in himself what could be done by a church if they were true to God, hoped that when the church came out of Babylonian captivity, they would very, very quickly accomplish the task which God gave them had given them to do, and Daniel knew that it could be done. But instead, God comes to him just before the fall of Babylon, in the third year of King Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon, and portrays before him an extended future in which there would rise a bear symbolizing a world empire which was not Israel, and after this would come the leopard and the dragon, then 10 kings, 3 would fall, a little horn power, and away down in the distance the judgment scene. Now Daniel knew by his own powerful experience that all that long delay was completely unnecessary. In other words, if we draw a line along here like this to indicate how long that delay actually was, then right down until this point of time, that constitutes a delay in the finishing of God's work. What might have been done back there, or for that matter at any stage along the way, will not be done until what is still a future point of time. Now when Daniel saw in vision that unnecessary delay, when he saw the world being dominated by Babylonian power after Babylonian power, when he recognized that meant unbelievable suffering and persecution for God's people, when it would give Satan an extension of time, when it meant that the desolation of this world and it's being brought right down to final obliteration, then can you wonder that Daniel was grieved by what God showed him in this vision? If, on the other hand, God could have shown him Israel coming out of Babylonian captivity as a chastened and faithful people who would make God to be Lord in everything, and a few short years of victory gained, God's kingdom established, then Daniel would have seen what he expected to see and would have been a very, very happy man indeed. A very, very happy man indeed. Now then, with that analysis of Daniel's feelings at that point of time, let's now look at this long delay as it was detailed in that particular prophecy. Come back now to Daniel, the 7th chapter, to continue our study of these points. Verse 15, as we read before, tells us that Daniel was grieved in his spirit in the midst of his body, and the visions of his head troubled him. I came near unto one of them that stood by, and asked him the truth of all this, so he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. Now in verses 17 and 18 we have a very, very brief interpretation of the entire vision. So brief that Daniel was not able to understand and therefore was not satisfied, with the result, of course, that he pressed for more information, as we shall read in just a moment. But first of all, verse 17, these great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. In those two verses, the one who stood by, obviously an angel messenger, gave a brief, but very much to the point, explanation of what Daniel had seen. Now there's no guesswork left so far as this thing is concerned. We're plainly told that the four beasts in the prophecy are four kings. And this doesn't mean individual kings, but it rather means world empires or kingdoms. The same as, to make this point quite clear, in Daniel the 2nd chapter, As you remember, God told Nebuchadnezzar that he was a great king. And in verse 39 of Daniel 2 it says, "And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee." Now this did not mean immediately after Nebuchadnezzar's death. As it turned out, of course, there were at least two more kings after Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar being the very last one. So when the word king is used, as in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, it doesn't mean the individual king, but rather the kingdom, that the kingdom which followed each other one in turn until four had come, which ruled over all the earth. So now we can begin to make a parallel between the two. And Daniel recognized at once, of course, that the lion was a symbol of the mighty power of Babylon, which at the time of the vision was about to pass into obscurity. We read this morning, of course, about the attack upon the city by Cyrus that brought down the kingdom of Belshazzar and left the city in absolute ruin. And the power which followed Babylon, of course, are symbolized by the bear, was Medo-Persia. As we know, of course, that from 608 BC to 538 BC was the period of domination of ancient Babylon, down to 331 BC, the domination of Medo-Persia. And then came the leopard with four heads and four wings that symbolized the great kingdom of Greece, which ruled the world till overcome by Rome in 168 BC. And Rome continued, of course, in power until the year 476 AD. These are BC dates back here, each of them. Now let's move on, because Daniel was not satisfied with this very brief explanation. In verse 19 he says, "Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured, broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet." Now, why didn't Daniel express interest in the first three of those four beasts? For the very simple reason that they were not to play an overly significant part in the persecution of God's people. It is true, of course, that Israel did have some trouble from the Medo-Persians, but not a great deal. Instead, the Medo-Persians' kings proved to be very helpful in releasing the Jews, giving them money, help and protection in the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple. And the Greeks, likewise, did not particularly dominate the people of God back at that point of time, excepting, of course, for Antiochus Epiphanes, of whom we'll learn a great deal more later. One of the later Seleucid kings, who for about 3 years, roughly, persecuted the Jews in Jerusalem until he himself was driven out very, very infamously by the Maccabean brothers. But when we come down to Rome, the fourth of these terrible beasts, we do have a power which gave the people of God an exceedingly bad time over a very, very long period. Because Daniel recognized the special role of this fourth beast, his attention was focused upon it, and he showed very little interest in the first, the second, and the third. He recognized, of course, that the first, second, and third tallied with the parts of the image back in Daniel 2, Babylon being the head of gold, Medo-Persia the breast and arms of silver, Greece the belly and thighs of brass. Now Daniel kind of reiterates the points in regard to this fourth beast to demonstrate how thoroughly he'd been impressed by the specifications in regard to this great monster. So let's now read from verses 19 down to 21 to see how Daniel expresses his interest in this particular power. Verse 19, Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. So that little horn power there in the head of that beast was something which really took the interest of Daniel and becomes the major symbol in the prophecy. Now verse 21, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and a time came that the saints possess the kingdom. Now that's Daniel's question. Of course, it covers the prophecy with his main interest in this little horn power, which was to dominate until the saints at last should take possession of the kingdom. And then, of course, the end of these earthly powers would have arrived forever. Now verse 23 gives to us the answer in more detail than given back there in verses 17 and 18. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. The prophecy therefore calls for the rise of ten kings after the beast power comes upon this earth. Between the years 476 AD and 533 AD, the Roman Empire broke up into exactly ten divisions. Coming from the far northeastern area of Europe and Asia were powerful bands, or powerful armies, I should better say, whole tribes or nations of people came pouring down to the northeast, and they were called the barbarians. They went by such names as Vandals, Ostrogoths, Visigoths, Suevi, Burgundians, Lombards, Heruli, Saxons, and so forth. And there were exactly ten of them all together. Between those years, 476 and 533 AD, which was a span of something like 57 years altogether, they broke up the Roman Empire into ten divisions. The Vandals occupied North Africa, for instance, and the Franks occupied what is now the territory of France, the Heruli occupied Italy, and so it went, until the entire kingdom of Rome was divided up into these ten powers. Now, when the attacks began, Rome had become quite decadent. Having conquered the world, they now had the riches of the world at their command, and Rome became a place of great revelry and debauchery and feasting and drunkenness and so forth, and the decay of the Roman Empire had well and truly set in by the time these very vigorous, hardy tribes came pouring down from the north and from the northeast. The frontier garrisons of the Romans, of course, found themselves beset by these tribes, which in some cases, of course, went around the outposts and attacked the centres further back, which forced the Romans to retreat in an ever-tightening circle from their far distant frontiers until they had come right back to the city of Rome itself. And then from there, the Roman emperor was forced to flee out of the city of Rome to a place called Byzantium. It later came to be called Constantinople, and presently is called Istanbul, and today, I believe, is the capital of Turkey. And now, no longer did pagan Rome rule the world. It was now ruled by these ten barbarian tribes. Now, at this point, we should draw, I think, a rough little map of Europe and Asia Minor. Don't expect to see, of course, the world's finest piece of cartography, because you won't. Here we have Asia Minor and the coastline of Palestine, the Nile Delta, and coming across here we have the northern part of Africa. And somewhere here is Greece, and we run up the Adriatic Sea, and here is the land of Italy, the boot, and come down here to Spain, and so on. Now, as I said, the Emperor of Rome had fled from Rome itself, and is now living over in this place which we presently call Istanbul, but in those days it was called Byzantium. At that time, the Vandals occupied North Africa. And up here in Italy, remember correctly, it was the Heruli, wasn't it? Anyone correct me on this? And occupied Italy was the Ostrogoths. I just lost my track on the order there, which of the two tribes was actually in Italy, which one displaced them. In any case, we'll come to the Vandals for a moment. The Vandals, like the rest of the barbarian tribes, were Arian. Now, an Arian is a person who does not believe that Jesus Christ is God. They have the belief that Jesus Christ was the first of all the created beings. He was preeminent, very special to God, but just the same, he was a created being in their view, that is, just like you and I. Except, of course, he is rather extraordinary and possessed some rather supernatural abilities. Now, the Roman Catholic Church, which at that time was developing because of the marriage between the apostate Christians and the pagan Romans, there was a bringing together of these two systems. The Sabbath was exchanged for Sunday, the day of the sun, and of course became the most important feast day of the week. The old Christmas, it wasn't called Christmas back in those days, of course, it was called the Day of Tammuz, and Christ's name was placed in the place of Tammuz, and it became then called Christmas, and Easter and all those great festivals were brought over from pagan Romanism and married to apostate Christianity. With the result that we have the development of what we now call the Roman Catholic system or the papal system. Now in the papal system, the belief is very strongly held that Jesus Christ is not a created being, that he is in fact God. And we agree with the Roman Catholic people on that point. Because Jesus Christ was not a created being, he is eternally pre-existent, he is God as the Father is, although he does occupy a place where he has two lives, as we saw previously in this week's studies back in the seed principle. And so there was a very bitter religious controversy between the Roman Catholic people on the one side and the Arians on the other side. And because the barbarians had the ascendancy so far as military power was concerned, and because state and church were always linked back in those days and never separated, the Arians were able to give the Roman Catholic people a very, very hard time, and nowhere so much as down here in North Africa. And the Vandals were persecuting the Roman Catholic people very, very intensely. So much so that they sent a plea for help to the Roman Emperor, whose name was Justinian. And Justinian, as I said before, was at that time living up here in the city of Byzantium. So Justinian called his general, he was also an admiral, and this man's name was Belisarius, a typical Roman name if you please, Belisarius. And he gave to Belisarius a considerable army and a formidable navy and sent him off down to deal with these Vandals. Now of course the word Vandal, as you know, today is used to describe a person who is very wantonly destructive. And that name comes to us because back in those days that's just what the Vandals were. Wherever they went they left scorched earth behind them. And they really tore the place up because they just simply seemed to love to see fires and death and destruction being inflicted, of course, on other people, not upon themselves. That's the way it usually goes, doesn't it? Now, so stirred up with the Roman Catholic people under Belisarius in regard to the destructive habits of these Vandals, they fell upon them so furiously as to literally wipe that tribe of people off the face of the earth. Now, this was very much a fulfillment of the prophecy. If you turn back with me to Daniel, the 7th chapter, and verse 8, it says, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. Now, I don't know how many of you folk have actually lived and worked on farms where cattle are involved, or any other horned creatures, such as goats perhaps, or even rams. Now, what happens if you take a horn and pluck it up by the roots? Does it ever grow again? Never. It's like taking a tooth out by the roots. Does it ever grow again? It's gone. So this does not picture the simple conquest of a nation, the enslavement of that nation. This envisages a genocide, which means the obliteration of that particular people off the face of the earth, so that their nationality is extinguished and will never again be seen so long as history shall last. Now there have been tribes which have vanished off the face of the earth. The Edomites, for instance, the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, all these various tribes have completely ceased to exist off the face of the earth. And so have the Vandals. They are plucked up by the roots and they therefore will never ever grow again. Now in the meantime, so I just have to check up on my history, I think the Heruli were actually in Rome, and the Ostrogoths, who occupied the territory just to the north of Italy, swept down and they wiped out the Heruli. And so horn number two was gone. And this began to happen, of course, in 533 AD. So the Vandals were gone and the Heruli were gone. That meant two of those 10 kingdoms had been torn up by the roots. And then Belisarius sailed across the Mediterranean Sea with his navy and army, landed in Italy, marched on the Ostrogoths and busily wiped them out. And so the third of those three kings were gone. They were the Vandals. Let's write their names up here. First of all, the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. Now, what must we expect to see happen immediately after the fall of these three kings? Right, the rise of the little horn power. It could not come upon the scene of action before those three kings fell, because it says, as it rose up, then those three kings fell to make way for it. So where there had been 10 horns, then there were 7 horns, and then there were 8 horns. And the little horn, of course, in the middle was one that was more stout than his fellows, and he had eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth that was speaking very, very great things. So he was different from the others in this respect, and became, of course, the most important symbol so far as the rest of the prophecy is concerned. He would continue for a space called in the Bible a time, times and a half a time, which period of time, of course, we know amounts to 1260 years, beginning in the year 538 and ending in the year 1798. But the details of that will have to leave to our next study period, because my little timepiece tells me it's time to stop at this point of time. So there we'll leave it until we come back to our next study period tomorrow morning.